from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Drums were beating in Washington this weekend, but they weren't war drums or threats from the White House. This time, they were drums of peace. Washington. Perhaps 100,000 people converged on Washington in the largest anti-war protest since the Vietnam era. Peace and prosperity have made large peace rallies a rarity in the nation's capital for years. But on Saturday, demonstrators from across the country descended on Washington. Arriving by the busload, they were Virginia suburbanites.
I just think people have gotten so complacent. I mean, everybody thinks they can't change anything. And the more people within normal society, so to speak, not on the fringes either way, the more people in the middle get out and protest, I think the easier it'll be for more people. We have a lot of friends coming that I don't think would have come unless we said, you know, you need to, this is important, you need to do something. And they did.
In college, I was a little more involved and aware of what was going on, but since then I've gotten more caught up with my life and job and career and all that kind of stuff, and the political activism side of me went a little dormant. And I came out here today to learn more about what's going on, to do background research, and not just the propaganda from different groups, but really to become more involved, to stay involved.
I'm from Egypt. I've been here for almost 22 years. I like here, I like my country, and all my kids are born here, and I don't like them. Nobody to look at them at the school for an evil eye, or this is an Arab, this is a tourist. We're not a tourist. We are, have heart, we are human, we're all brother and sister. We need to live in peace together, here or there and anywhere on earth.
I've been living in this country for 24 years, and I believe war doesn't achieve anything. The only thing that war achieves is misery to people. You know, as an Arab American, I have to address these issues, you know, in a daily basis.
They were college professors and inner-city school teachers.
We're all educators. We all work with children on a daily basis. That's our careers. So what needs to happen is us taking this back to people who it matters, the 16 and 17-year-olds that we work with. That's the people who are going to be doing the voting. We need to increase their consciousness.
Faculty and students are
very active again. For the first time in, you know, since Vietnam, at least, and maybe since the Civil Rights Movement.
There were, for a day, streets full of Americans against war in Iraq. No bombs on Baghdad, they chanted. No war for oil. They marched past Constitution Gardens and the Vietnam War Memorial, past landmarks of American triumph and tragedy. Shoulder to shoulder, they circled the White House and laid out their case against war, against the media, against elected representatives who they feel don't represent them.
I mean, it's obvious by the way our Congress people represented us just a couple of weeks ago. I mean, there's a majority of the American population is against the war, yet they go ahead and give Bush a blank check to do whatever he wants. So, I mean, I think, no, they don't hear us. If you're asking, does corporate media give us any credit and put us on television and report what's going on, no. As far as that's concerned, I feel that we're silenced. But I think it usually gets out through grassroots movements. And thanks to the Internet, people now have more access.
I think we are a mass media society, and we're highly dependent on what we learn through the media. And I don't think that they've covered the full aspects of it. It's really surprising.
We're here because our senator didn't bother to ask us before he voted for this specific issue. He just went ahead and did what he thought, you know, was the most popular thing. And didn't raise any questions with any of us, whether we were concerned about it or what the ethical aspects of it were. So we feel that we have to be here just to be counted, to be part of it.
Listeners, President Bush has presented his case for war. Conservatives, liberals, pundits, and politicians from across the political spectrum have lined up across the country and on this show and described why they are ready to support an invasion of Iraq. Tonight, we're hearing the case against war from people who protested this weekend in Washington. If you're against the war yourself, why? Is your objection moral, political, or economic? If you're for war, if you're ready for war, Does the protesters' anti-war message give you second thoughts or not? And do rallies and demonstrations make a difference in America today? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Cleveland, Ohio, is Reverend Bob Edgar, General Secretary of the National Council of the Churches of Christ and former six-term member of the Congress from Pennsylvania. Good evening and welcome, Bob Edgar.
It's good to be with you.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Washington is Karen Dolan, a fellow at the Progressive, the Institute for Policy Studies, the nation's oldest progressive think tank. Good evening and welcome to On Point, Karen Dolan.
Good evening, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on with us, Karen. Bob Edgar, let me jump in with you. We've talked this issue up one side and down the other. And, I must say we've heard reservations and we've heard reasons for war. We've heard both. And we've heard both from both conservatives and recently from liberals as well. This weekend in Washington, we saw the first big protest against war in the nation's capital. You were there. You've been thinking a lot about this anti-war movement. Give it to us, Bob Edgar. What, in your view, is the case, the best case, against war with Iraq?
Before I answer that question, let me just say that I think the difference now from the time when I served in Congress and we shut down the Vietnam War is not the left or the right, but the middle. In my position as General Secretary of the National Council of Churches, I have seen a commitment on the part of bishops and archbishops and laypersons within the mainline churches and within the Orthodox traditions and the historic Black church traditions stand up and ask some tough questions about this war differently than they did back in Vietnam when it took the churches and the people in the middle 10 to 15 years to actually find their way to opposing our involvement in Vietnam.
It's a good point, and I'm glad you make it. There's not the same left-right polarization in many ways. In many ways, the whole nation is looking at this and trying to make up its mind.
I think that's right, and I think there are a couple issues. I think there are questions about the unintended consequences of going to war. I took a group of religious leaders to Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Israel, Palestine, and went into Jenin right after the Israelis left that devastated area. And I think many persons are concerned about what does a first strike against Iraq do to escalating the violence in the Middle East rather than dealing with the issue of finding a road to peace between Israel and Palestine. That's one question. The second question for religious people, we have people who are Christians in Iraq providing humanitarian aid. Our television shows pictures of Saddam Hussein holding up a rifle. You don't see the pictures of children holding up empty bowls. And we know that more than half of the casualties, if we go to war, are going to be civilians. And so it's important for us to ask, what are the reasons for going to war at this time? If you use the administration's argument that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, we know that many nations have weapons of mass destruction. Does that mean we now go after every nation that has them? If it's to go after terrorists, we know that terrorists are in some 60 different countries. We saw in Washington recently a sniper. Do you bomb Washington because there's a sniper? Would bombing the United States have helped us against the Oklahoma bomber? In 60 or more countries, there are terrorists. And rather than thinking about just simply bombing nations to get at terrorism, we may in fact create more terrorists than we eliminate by that strategy. And a number of thoughtful people who, I think to a person, oppose Saddam Hussein for his brutal tactics, question whether the right approach to eliminating Saddam Hussein as the leader of Iraq is a land invasion against that country.
Karen Dolan, you and Bob Edgar and maybe 75,000 or 100,000 or more people were in Washington this weekend. Does the case that Bob Edgar has just outlined, does it seem to fairly represent the kind of thinking that you heard on the streets in Washington, the kind of thinking that you're doing yourself about the case against war against Iraq?
I think it does, and I think One thing that seems to be on everyone's mind and the first question that people, you know, from peace activists to students to the average person on the street that people ask is, why Iraq and why now? We haven't been shown proof of an imminent threat from Iraq. In fact, our own intelligence sources, the CIA, has reported that there is no imminent threat from Iraq. but that Iraq would be in a position to retaliate if they were attacked. So people see this, they hear the arguments on the other side, they don't hear an argument that's convincing coming from the Bush administration, and I think that that's sort of the common sense first question that most people seem to have.
What about the question, I guess the threat behind all of this is the weapon of mass destruction threat. President Bush has said that Saddam Hussein is working on weapons of mass destruction. He has many biological and chemical already, that they're working on building a nuclear weapon, and that he believes Saddam Hussein, and others say the same, would use it if and when it's created, or might even pass it on to terrorist forces who would use it third hand and maybe not even leaving fingerprints. We've seen what's apparently happened in North Korea, where negotiations over nuclear weapons seemed to be working and now seem not to be working. They apparently have a weapon. Do you not have a concern, Karen Dolan, that such weapons in the hands of Saddam Hussein would be a great threat both to the region and to the United States?
Well, I think the answer to that is that the Bush administration or anyone else has made a convincing case that Saddam Hussein is on the brink of acquiring weapons of mass destruction. We know from the UN weapons inspections that he doesn't possess those at this time.
We know that he did have many chemical and biological weapons. I mean, many were destroyed, and as far as I know, the presumption is that he continues to have such weapons.
I think that's accurate. This is Bob Edgar.
Yes, Bob.
I think that's accurate. We helped him and supplied him with the ingredients to make some chemical and biological weapons that he used against his own people.
Very directly, and against the Iranians.
And Jane's magazine indicates that their assessment is that he does have chemical and biological mm-hmm. weapons, but he has a very limited ability to deliver those weapons with perhaps as many as 20 to 30 launchers that have no capacity beyond 400 miles. The threat of Saddam Hussein is to the Middle East and to Israel more so than it is to the United States. But I think the point that has to be made is that's true of Pakistan, that's true of North Korea, it's true of a number of nations, some of whom we have called allies, who have developed weapons of mass destruction. Are we launching a foreign policy that simply says if a country has weapons of mass destruction, we should have them, but they should not? I think we need to institute some diplomatic procedures and to begin to put together treaties and diplomatic efforts to reduce the number and size of weapon systems, including our own. We complain about landmines, but we distribute landmines as though they are an effective tool around the world, and then we find ourselves having to respond to the many children that are hurt by landmines.
But Bob Edgar, aren't we making distinctions here? I hear the Bush administration saying Saddam Hussein is working on a nuclear weapon and he has the readiness to use it, perhaps in a way that Pakistan does not, perhaps in a way that North Korea does not. To be made?
Yeah, I think that's a hard case to make in terms of Pakistan, because Pakistan is threatened by India, and they have a border area that they're in conflict over, and Pakistan, even as we've made nice with someone who has taken over by military coup.
General Musharraf.
Right. Mm-hmm. There are a number of places on the planet where escalation of violence could take place very quickly. I'm not an apologist for Saddam Hussein, mm-hmm. but I do think that it's too simple to say, let's go to war with Iraq. Let's kill not only the leadership of the government, but perhaps thousands of other persons on a first strike strategy. And I think people in the church, who many of whom are committed to a just war concern, don't find the justification for this war at this time.
Bob Edgar, Karen Dolan, stand by. There's a lot to talk about. We're looking at the case against war with protesters from Saturday's peace rally in Washington. Are you listening to the anti-war message? Is it persuasive to you? Were you in Washington this weekend to protest? Were you there in spirit? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. anti-war protest in Washington.
Most of our wars are well edited. They don't hear about the tragic outcome, the collateral damage. They just go on, you know, until they get theirs, and they get upset, you know. So
I last marched in Grand Rapids, Michigan in 1962 for civil rights, and that's the last time I marched. But I'm into this one. I mean, I think it's ridiculous to give the president the power to make unilateral war in Iraq.
This country's like a war machine under President Bush's administration leadership. So, and at the same time, this war is a diversion to keep people looking at the real issue of this country. Like, people can't find jobs, people can't find homes, people are losing jobs. It's an unjust war. It's like Vietnam. We had no business over there.
Voices from the weekend protests in Washington. We're talking tonight about the case against war with Iraq with protesters from Saturday's peace rally in Washington. You can join the conversation, too. Are you listening to the anti-war message? Is it persuasive to you? Were you in Washington this weekend? Were you there in spirit? And if you oppose war with Iraq, what's the basis of your opposition? Is it moral, political, pragmatic? Is it an economic critique? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight, and happy to be so, by Reverend Bob Edgar. He was a longtime congressman from Pennsylvania's 7th District. He's currently General Secretary of the National Council of the Churches of Christ and was in Washington this weekend. By Karen Dolan. She's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, the nation's oldest progressive think tank. Karen was at the protests. And now joined from Morris, Minnesota, by Lorena Brown. She's a senior studying biology at the University of Minnesota in Morris. Good evening and welcome, Lorena Brown.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. I understand that you were all the way from Minnesota in Washington this weekend. How did you get there, and what did you hear and see?
I myself actually flew in, blessed frequent flyer miles, but there are about 29 other students that drove in cars, rental cars, and their own cars to be there. We were all very committed to be there. And I guess as far as what I saw, I was very impressed by the crowd just by the numbers. I think there were at least 100,000 people there. I've never seen such a big protest in my life. And then also just by the variety that was represented in the crowd. I mean, obviously we're all familiar with a lot of people that are usually at peace protests, and that's kind of the same kind of crowd. But here I saw people from all different backgrounds. And
such as, Lorena, give us a sense of what you saw in the crowd.
Well, just basically a lot of diversity. I mean, people, there were families there with their kids, and there were, you know, obviously there were plenty of college students, and there were senior citizens there, and a lot of different ethnic minorities were represented, and it was all very colorful. I felt like there was a lot of just sort of unification of thought. I don't know. What we all wanted to get across was just basically peace. Mm-hmm. And I really did like, too, that there was no direct action taken. It was all a very peaceful peace protest.
So this wasn't like the anti-globalization protests where there's a lot of have been smashed windows and some pretty rough stuff.
Right. There was like no riot energy there at all. Mm-hmm. We all just wanted to make sure that we were heard, and you know, we were using our rights as far as freedom of speech and the right to peaceably assemble, and that's all we were interested in, is getting some publicity for this cause that we were all unified behind.
Lorena, how old are you?
I'm 22.
Had you been to an anti-war protest before this weekend?
No, I've never been to any protest.
Did it live up to your expectations? Was it delivering the message you want delivered about war with Iraq?
Yeah, I was really impressed. There were a lot of different messages represented, due to the diversity, but the one unifying principle is just that we all want peace, and that the war with Iraq isn't, it is not viable for us right now, and there's not enough reason, I guess, to support war with Iraq.
Lorena, let me just ask you about that. We're looking at the case against war tonight. You say we want peace, but are there circumstances under which you would support war with Iraq?
I guess maybe if there was actually some sort of proof that we were about to be directly threatened. But right now, that's just not... I mean, I can't even imagine Hussein, what he would be able to get out of an attack on America at this point. I mean, he has to know that there would be massive global ramifications, and that would be the end of his regime, and obviously a lot of strife throughout the world would come out of an action like that. And Yeah, I can't even imagine it happening right now. And we have no proof that it is going to be an issue at all in the future. I think that there are some other ulterior motives that might be leading to the problems we're having in America with Iraq right now.
Such as?
Well, I think that it's been shown that the president is a lot more popular when there is some kind of social crisis going on, and that the administration is fighting to keep its approval rating. And also just oil. I mean, we're addicted to oil in this country. I don't think we need to be. But, I mean, obviously that country has a lot of power over the supply of oil in the world, and we're afraid that it's going to become less available to us.
So you're chucking it up to politics and maybe to oil. Bob Edgar, you've been around Washington for a long time, since before the Vietnam War Memorial was there. What did it feel like to be starting an anti-war protest from the edge of the Vietnam War Memorial?
Well, actually, it felt very positive that we could speak out and be good patriotic Americans. It felt a little bit of disappointment that we have not found alternative means to war since the experiences of the 60s and 70s. It felt as though we had not fully explored all the diplomatic options and the possibilities of working with the families of nations. But the thing that I think feels good is that at the before a war is started, average, ordinary, common individuals are stepping forward to ask the tough questions. And I didn't see that in the 60s. I was on the House floor in April of 1975 when we shut down the war in Vietnam. And even in the last hours of shutting down the war, there were still some who wanted to reimpose troops. And with the help of Tip O'Neill and others, we were able to say enough is enough, and we moved on. It's interesting that we now have full diplomatic relations and trade relations with Vietnam, and we have relations with Saudi Arabia and China, two countries that have abuses of their power and against some of their citizens. They tend to be friends now, and we don't have a foreign policy that's based on consistency or those kind of moral judgments. And I agree with my colleague here who just spoke, that she mentioned about our addiction to oil. Obviously, our whole policy to the Middle East has been much more related to our economic interests than to really finding a solution for Israel and Palestine to build some bridges of peace and to work with the nations in the region. Why is it that Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and other nations in the region are not supporting our efforts against Saddam Hussein?
A reasonable question. Karen Dolan, I have to say, as I listen to the three of you, and there are more voices waiting to come in, the thing that's different here from those ready to support war is a sense of urgency, a sense of threat, a sense of American vulnerability. By comparison, I hear a relative level of comfort with the potential threat from Iraq. Are you not worried that in an era of weapons of mass destruction being delivered openly or covertly, that there is a new vulnerability? Are you not concerned that the U.S. may need to reach out more aggressively than it has in the past because technology makes such large-scale destruction possible?
What I'm hearing from people who are involved in this broad anti-war movement is that, contrary to being afraid of an attack from Iraq, people are more afraid of an attack from terrorists. They're afraid that this focus on Iraq, where nuclear weapons are not posing a threat at this point, that this is a diversion from the war on terrorism. That's where that's where people's fears come into play more so. And people are asking, again, I say, the question about why Iraq? Why are we not concentrating on the war on terrorism that we started? And that's where the vulnerability comes from.
Karen, Bob, Lorena, lots of callers want to join us. Let's invite them in. Marianne's calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Marianne. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Good to have you.
Thank you. I really appreciate the subject matter.
Mm-hmm. What's on your mind, Marianne?
Well, we had. I wanted to talk about the protests that happened in Spokane on Saturday, and just to kind of to let folks know or remind folks that protests happened all across the country
and around the world. I guess there were protests in many cities. How many people showed up in Spokane, Marianne?
Absolutely. Well, in Spokane, we had about 1,500 people, which is the biggest demonstration or rally. Political rally Spokane has seen in many, many years since about the Vietnam War is what I understand.
Where did you gather?
We gathered at the community building, which is here in Spokane, and walked to the federal building and had a rally. But what was really stunning about it, besides the numbers, I mean, we were just amazed. We knew there was going to be a good turnout, but we had no idea there'd be that many people. And it was an amazing cross-section of people. There were elders, there were children, middle-class people. There were families there straight in from soccer practice. The kids still had their soccer equipment on. There were people in wheelchairs. I mean, it was such a stunning display of concern from the heartland.
That's a different kind of profile than I remember from Vietnam-era protests, where it was mainly young college students primarily.
Yeah. Very different, and very different from my experience as well. I mean, I went through the Vietnam stuff, too.
Marianne, let me ask you just quickly. A lot of people want to join us, but do you think your protests, these protests, can make a difference?
Yes, I do. I do believe that they can make a difference. And we're already seeing that in the way the Bush administration has had to back off in the last 2 weeks, partly in response to the fact that France and Russia have such serious economic investment in Iraq and are therefore refusing to go along with America's attempt to simply go in and take over the oil fields.
But I wonder if we're really backing off. The talk now is that the United States is losing patience with the UN Security Council and will very soon deliver an ultimatum, support us or, you know, be with us or be without us, but we're going.
Yeah, and that worries me a lot. Because I don't know how many folks saw the National Security Strategy paper that was actually written before the election. It's real clear that the Bush administration has all along had an intention to go in and take the oil fields. If they can't get them by a proxy nation, we'll take them ourselves.
Well, I don't know about that, but they certainly are ready to take preemptive action. Marianne, thanks for your call. Michael's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing? I went down there. This is the very first protest I've ever gone to. I mean,
you were in Washington this weekend, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I supported, you know, the previous wars, even Vietnam at the time. But you know, this is so insane. I mean, I think the only reason he's doing this is because Saddam tried to kill his father, for one, and it's a cheap election ploy. I mean, the only thing that's keeping Bush's popularity ratings up in the 60s is the fact that he's this big martial leader. And give him credit, he did really well in Afghanistan, or Cheney and Rumsfeld did really well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, a continuation of that, but I think coupled with all the violence in Israel, if we invaded Iraq now, we would be subject to a dozen years of terrorism.
What do you think of the odds that we will invade Iraq?
I don't know. You know, I don't think the Security Council is going to go for it, period. And I don't know if Bush has the actual guts to do it, you know, in the face of really opposition from the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's a 1.2 billion Muslims, and we can't fight them all. I mean, you can see what one lunatic with a rifle did in Washington. And, you know, one interesting thing was the Rose Garden was open that day for the yearly tour.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially the protesters could have gotten on the grounds of the White House and unfurled their message right in front of the windows and then, I guess, been beaten by, like, harp seals. But
of course, the president was in Mexico, but it sounds like it was a pretty orderly protest. Michael, thanks for calling in with the firsthand report. Bob Edgar, you know Washington from your many years in Congress. At this point, how effective do you think such protests can be? Is this train up on the rails and you're laying down seeds for future resistance, or can you really hope to forestall a war?
Well, let's say a couple things. So one is the protest in and of itself is not going to stop the war.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the comment from the woman from Washington State. Back in the 80s, I went over to Germany to participate in some peace rallies that they had. And they had convinced their media to count all the people who protested in all the cities so that they could state that millions of people were protesting rather than simply counting the people on the lawn of the White House or on the mall in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the second point that has to be really made is that this is the beginning of a national conversation, national debate. I was a member of Congress. I know that the vote in the House and the vote in the Senate was not a vote to say, Mr. President, go to war. It's not automatic that the president is going to go to war if, in fact, the United Nations backs off and does not support his efforts. And I think there's an important national conversation taking place. You're going to have an election next week. That's going to tell some stories. You're going to have the president, after the election, having to come back and pass some legislation. There'll be more conversation taking place at that point. And also, you've got people like Jimmy Carter, who's not thought of as a flaky liberal, who is going to receive the Nobel Peace Prize in early December. Some of us are organizing religious efforts and prayer vigils and other things in mainline, ordinary, common churches to celebrate not only Jimmy Carter's achievement, but that there is an alternative view. So I don't think that it's automatic that we're going to go to war, and I don't think that we should minimize the importance of what took place on Saturday as a beginning of a conversation, not as an end of a conversation.
Karen Dolan, how about you? Do you share the view that the protest on Saturday in Washington and in other locations has an impact, or is it a message that's simply dragging a small foot out of a racing car?
Well, I think, as Bob said, the protest on Saturday in and of itself is not going to change things. It is part of a larger conversation. It's part of a movement that, as other folks here have mentioned, mm-hmm. is broader, larger, more diverse, both demographically and geographically, than we've seen, and especially at this stage in the game when there is not yet the bombs dropping in a war situation. So I think that because the voices are loud and are getting louder and the media is beginning to report this, that it's something that can't be ignored, and in fact really hasn't been ignored, even in the vote, even in the congressional vote. As Bob says, that vote was not a vote to go to war. In fact, 63% of the House Democrats voted no in defiance of their own leaders, their own party leadership, and 42% of the senators, Democratic senators, voted no. And
yes, but Senator Bush President Bush certainly took it as, or will take it as, a green light, and they've been very clear about that. Karen Dolan, stand by. We'll be back and talk more. Reverend Bob Edgar, Lorena Brown. We're talking tonight about the case against war with protesters from Saturday's peace rally in Washington. If you support war on Iraq, what do you think of the anti-war messages we're hearing tonight? Are you swayed by the peace movement? Is there any chance that peace marches will stop this war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for this program comes from OSR, consultants specializing in Windows to
Peace Rally in Washington, D.C. My guests tonight are Reverend Bob Edgar. He's General Secretary of the National Council of the Churches of Christ and a former six-term congressman from Pennsylvania's 7th District. Karen Dolan, who's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, the nation's oldest progressive think tank in Washington, and from the University of Minnesota in Morris, Lorena Brown, 21 years old, a senior studying biology at the University of Minnesota. You can join us as well. Does America rally more easily to peace or to war? Is there any chance that peace marches will stop this war? Is the anti-war movement getting short shrift in the media? And what is the peace movement's best answer to Saddam Hussein? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. John's calling from Weymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Hi. Good. All this, I think the country itself is way too forgiving and quick to forget. The UN sanctions against Iraq, mm-hmm. and as the world agreed going way back, is the original argument for us to go in. And why is everybody forgetting this? I don't understand.
You mean if Saddam's breaking all the rules, why don't we enforce the rules?
The whole country agreed, and everybody seems to be backing off. We talk about Syria and these other countries now, as a caller mentioned earlier, saying, mm-hmm. well, why are they disagreeing? Well, why aren't they voicing their opinion? They're not voicing their opinion because they're afraid of Saddam.
John, hang on. Let me put that to Bob Edgar. Bob, here's the argument, and we've heard it from President Bush and recently in the New Republic from a liberal columnist saying if liberals support international law and Saddam is flouting that law, it's got to be enforced. It's time for war if necessary.
Well, I think war is a last option, not a first option. I think we can stop threatening violently to overthrow Saddam Hussein.
Even after 10 years of attempts to enforce?
I think we put Iraq on a back burner, and I guess the one positive thing about this conversation is that Iraq is on the front burner.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we have diplomats talking face-to-face with Iraq like we have diplomats now over discovering that North Korea has nuclear capability beyond what they had anticipated?
We had essentially inspection teams. They got kicked out. It hasn't been easy to talk to Saddam, and he hasn't been very open until this threat of invasion, has he?
Well, I think that he's more open today. I think we can resume direct negotiations. I think we can demilitarize the conflict with Iraq and end some of the inhumane economic sanctions, because clearly Saddam Hussein is responsible for many of the deaths that took place because of the sanctions, but many children are dying and suffering because of the sanctions that we've placed on Iraq. I think we need to get back into the diplomatic process and not move to the war process. Let me answer the first comment that the caller made.
Mm-hmm.
I visited with the Prime Minister of Lebanon, spent 2 hours with the President of Syria, spent about an hour and a half with the King of Jordan, and not one of them who live in the region were ready to go at a military action against Iraq. In fact, the Prime Minister of Lebanon said to me directly, if you want to remove the government of Iraq, that's one thing, but don't assassinate the children of Iraq. Recognize that the nation of Iraq has some people who are not that enthralled with their leader, and let's figure out a strategy to marginalize Saddam Hussein with the nations in the region who have most at stake. If Saddam Hussein is going to use the chemical and biological weapons that he has, he's going to use them on his neighbors much more quickly than he's going to use them on the United States.
But Saddam Hussein has been in power since the late 70s. His neighbors have not had much influence on him without the military back in the United States. He invaded Kuwait. How is this supposed to happen?
Remember, Tom, that we supported Saddam because we didn't like Iran.
We supported him very richly, including, as you say, giving him weapons of chemical and biological weapons.
That's correct. And so we have created a monster that we're now trying to control.
But does that make a difference? I mean, if you've got a monster, you've got a monster, don't you?
Well, but you've got a monster that hasn't. I think it was appropriate for us when he invaded Kuwait to stop the invasion.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case right now. But the case right now is that you've got a leader who has a brutal history that has not directly attacked either a neighbor or the United States directly. And for us to invent a first strike policy not only has unintended consequences in the Middle East, but it also sends messages to other leaders around the world that it's okay for them to make unilateral or bilateral strikes against enemies that they perceive at their borders, and think that we've got to be careful moving into the future. The firestorms of Dresden were not caused by nuclear weapons. They were caused by conventional weapons.
And Russia is talking today about striking internationally when and where it pleases, as the threat of terror has loomed larger there. So perhaps you're right that more people will look at preemptive action. Holly's calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, Holly. You're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Ashbrook. I was certainly in D.C. in spirit and was looking on the wee hours on C-SPAN to hear some of the speakers.
Yeah.
And then I was totally appalled at the lukewarm coverage in the print media.
What do you mean by lukewarm coverage?
Well, there was a small article on page 8 of the New York Times. I have a subscription to that. Mm-hmm. There was a small article in the Globe. I have a subscription to that. I was ranting today and close to really canceling my subscriptions because I think it's appalling. And I think that this has been a pattern. For the last months,
playing down the voices of peace.
I think war and rumors of war sell sell newspapers and certainly, you know, get these reactionary pundits, not you, you know, really invested in getting people impassioned about, you know, I think the wrong issues or issues that are one-dimensional.
And yet the media is called liberal. Holly, thanks for your call. Let me put it to Karen Dolan. Our time's ticking down. But Karen, what's your sense of how the American media have handled the voices of peace that are there, that were there this weekend and have been there around the country?
Well, I think your caller is right in that it's very difficult to break through to the mainstream media when the war drums play better, more exciting than the peace message. But what I think is important to see, the Washington Post had it front page.
And a pretty big story.
And a big story. And unlike in the days of old when they underreported folks who were there, for instance, during the Gulf War march, was vastly undercounted, they're not doing that now. And I think that it's because the movement has become louder, has become so big, and because it consists of the soccer moms and, as one caller said, people coming straight from soccer practice and senior citizens and young people, that it's the voice of America, and that was seen in Congress by the overwhelming letters that arrived in offices in opposition.
So it can't just be called crazy college kids or something like it might have
That's
in the
right.
60s. Lorena Brown, let me put it to you. What did your parents think of you heading off to an anti-war protest in Washington, D.C.?
It was actually my mom's frequent flyer miles that got me the ticket.
This is boomer support for a new generation of anti-war protests, frequent flyer miles.
Exactly. A lot of people are really supportive. And my parents themselves went to the protest we had in Minneapolis, which, by the way, was underreported as far as numbers go. And a lot of the other protests, there was one I think that was turned into more of a Wellstone event when it actually had originally just been a peace protest and was reported differently there. But, you know, as far as support from parents and different, I mean, the vans that came from Morris, Minnesota, were a lot of them were parents' cars. I mean,
Lorena Brown, we're almost out of time. Did you come home inspired? Did you come home hopeful?
Yeah, of course I did.
Thanks for being with us. Lorena Brown is a senior studying biology at the University of Minnesota in Morris. And Karen Dolan at the Institute for Policy Studies, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Reverend Bob Edgar, General Secretary of the National Council of the Churches of Christ, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. This is On Point. Among the peace protesters in Washington last weekend were many college students who came by bus to join the rally. Producer George Hicks traveled with anti-war students on their way to Washington and asked about why they felt the need to attend.
It's too drastic to say, like, our one protest is going to stop the war, but it might be more feasible to say that our voices will encourage other people to, you know, be more vocal.
I don't know if I believe that it's actually going to make an effective difference to the administration, seeing as 1.5 million people in Italy got, like, no coverage on any media in the United States, as far as I know, not any serious coverage anyway. 500,000 people in England did not. I think it's very important. Is it viable? Is it going to make a difference? I'm not sure. I hope it does.
I happen to disagree with my friend here. I think that it does make a difference. It's a way to collectively voice our opinions, and hopefully that some interested people watching on television or hearing at their church on Sunday or in their schools will happen to be sympathetic to the message that we're trying to put out there and maybe get involved and then therefore sway public opinion.
What kind of turned me off to activism around, like, when I was a senior in high school, I got really kind of apathetic about it because I didn't feel like my voice was being heard, and I feel like it's more coming out now in this kind of grassroots organizing. I see more of a dialogue going on than I've ever seen before.
You know, one person can be fighting for gay rights, and one person can be fighting against racism, and one person will be fighting with feminism, but they're all sectioned off and nobody's working together. That's what's nice about anti-war stuff, is that it affects everybody.
There's definitely a big change from high school to college, just because college campuses are so much more conducive to, like, political activism. You know, there's a greater amount of young people who all share their ideas, and there's more, like, I don't know, influential teachers who promote activism and tell you you can actually change the world, so you actually want to go out there and do something about it.
My teacher in the STEM department at Mass College of Art, he encourages students to participate in the activism because it's he definitely feels that youth are a strong force in our nation, you know. So he was willing to help fund my trip down to D.C. because he was so eager for students to be involved.
A lot of people have spent the last 20 years sitting back and enjoying their ridiculous rich lives and being happy with that. I want people to stand up and say this is wrong.
Yeah. You just sit at home at college, all the people just chilling, whatever. You're like, the history is being written, you know, and the only palpable, like, sort of demonstration that, you know, you're just not an ignorant bastard just sitting back home, like, not caring about, you know, the world around you, you know? This is sort of just a manifestation of that, really. It's like you feel so guilty. You're like, I got to do something.
I don't think that we're necessarily our viewpoints are a minority, but I think as far as being active about it, that's a minority.
At my school, I may be in a minority, but at other schools and other friends of mine that don't go to school with me, they believe in the same thing that I believe in. They're the ones that got me to come to these kind of demonstrations.
I think I'm surrounded by people involved. In my school in particular, there's been a lot of growing activism in the past few months in particular because a lot of the immigrant students have been targeted.
No, actually, it's only like me and my brother. So it's like we're outnumbered. It's been very tense, like, since September 11 and other things that have happened. I try to keep my chin high, you know, and I'm hanging in there. Yeah.
Voices from college students at this weekend's anti-war protests in Washington, D.C. We'd like to end this hour with another moment from this weekend's rally. You're listening to the guitar of punk rock legend Patti Smith as she begins to perform for the Washington audience of peace protesters. As Smith began to sing, the crowd realizes that the rock star's vocal microphone isn't working. To save the day, one zealous protester jumped on stage to fill in with a mantra all his own. We'd like to leave you with it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.